Welcome to Tribe of Two, the officially unofficial podcast for The Mandalorian on Disney Plus. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 1, titled Chapter 9. I don't know. They don't get very... Yeah, all the creativity that goes into these shows, and they neglect to give them episode names.
Yeah, we have precedence for this. Episode 4, colon, A New Hope.
Chapter 9,
you do this
colon.
Chapter 9, colon.
Cobb Vanth.
You know, Bantha Poodoo.
Like Boba Fett. Yeah.
The Marshal. There's so many. This chapter stuff. What is this? Legion on FX? FX Hulu? This is Disney Plus. I want a colon. I want a proper subtitle.
Take the plus off Disney. Just call it Disney because you're not plussing
That's
it.
That's what it is.
You're not plussing those episode names. What'd you think of the episode aside from the name?
I thought it was good. Like when I sucked my teeth and I saw it's 55 minutes long, I'm like, wow, okay. We'll see what if this is going to be groaning under an extra 15 minutes of fat, but it still felt very breezy, very fun. There's so much Star Wars references and like lore building packed into this episode.
Yeah.
Timothy Oliphant apparently is working in a rider into his contracts that he must play a marshal in every fucking role that he has. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even mad. He's a brilliant part addition to the Star Wars universe. I guess my only complaint is we didn't get a lot of Baby Yoda. We got two or three like cute scenes. His ears flapping in the wind, the breeze of the speeder bike was adorable. Him retreating into his Baby Yoda bassinet right before the ass kicking started was cute.
Yeah.
But you know, he's taking a literal back seat in this episode. What'd you think?
Yeah, he got kicked out of the way in this episode, literally. I agree. Like I found myself just really enjoying the episode, and not even noticing that it was an extra long episode. You know, it starts with a recap of season one, so there are a couple minutes there. So it's not quite as long as maybe it seems.
True.
It flew by. I really enjoyed like seeing more of the Tusken Raiders culture, kind of like, you know, having discussions, seeing that they keep all these pets and stuff aside from just Banthas. I don't know, that stuff was really interesting to me. And I know probably a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about is in like comic books and, you know, Star Wars Rebels and Clone Wars and stuff, which I haven't
seen. The Aftermath trilogy.
Yeah, all that stuff. Cobb Vanth, I guess, is not a new character, but he's new to me. A lot of this stuff was just like, oh, look at that. You know, that's a new thing for Star Wars. Graffiti in Star Wars. Oh, my God. I had no idea. We'll talk about all that stuff. But it was fun. Ton of fun.
It was a lot of fun. One thing I noticed, and I don't know if it's going to be just for Timothy Oliphant or it's something that they're doing new for the sound design. The bounty hunter now, when he walks around, jingle jangles like a cowboy. Like
his got spurs.
His Beskar armor makes that kind of jingle jangle as he's walking around. Nice. Now, I noticed Kim Renfro had an interview with the sound designer or maybe the composer, and I guess they mixed in that spur sound throughout season one, but I went back and listened, and I didn't hear it, and I was thinking that like this is either an in-universe nod to just how very spaghetti Star Wars Western this was, or it's something between the symbol on his shoulder or his jet pack is now jingle jangly. But I love it because that's these guys are gunfighters and the old Outer Rim West of Star Wars.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun
for sure, and you know even. Even down to like Mos Pelgo being a frontier town, right? Like these old ramshackle wooden. You got a general store and maybe a couple of houses and a motel if you're lucky, or a cantina.
Yeah. Yeah, I kept on thinking about how tightly coupled. Like, it would not surprise me if later this year. I guess it's already pretty late this year. Next year, Disney announces that there's going to be a Mandalorian MMO. Because, like, I couldn't help but think, like, when the Mando is saying, like, I've been quested to do this or that, I'm like, you're literally, you're talking about a video game quest. And then this entire episode is essentially a live-action version of a real side quest that you could play in the old Knights of the Old Republic. Right down to killing a crate?
Uh-huh.
How do you say that?
Getting the pearl?
Getting the crate dragon, getting the pearl from it as your loot. All that stuff. just seamlessly feeds one from the other to the one. And I was just thinking, like, oh, I can see it. I can see it. You have your customizable ship, your customizable armor. You go to your guild leader, and he gives you the quests of the week, and you've got long-term seasonal quests, and, you know.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that they've done in, like, Old Republic, because, you know, there is a current Star Wars MMO, but how I don't know how big a part the Mandalorians are of that. Presumably they could be.
Is there actually a Star Wars MMO right now? I thought that that had gone defunct.
No, I think Old Republic is still running.
Huh. All right.
The other one, Galaxies, I'm pretty sure is not running. God, that's 20 years old at this point.
Yeah. That was real. Yeah. I remember being excited about that when we were teenagers. Uh-huh. But anyway, yeah, it's a nice, it's some of the best Star Wars that they're making right now. And you can tell the people really give a shit. You know, a lot of these, like, references and Easter eggs are just fun for the fans, but a lot of it is just like having respect for your material. You know, how should Banthas, or how should sand people ride their Banthas? Well, old fucking Ben Kenobi said they ride them single file to hide their numbers. By God, they actually remembered. So when you see a bunch of them riding together, they're in single file to hide their numbers. Like, I don't know why other franchises struggle with that. Like, it's like not, it's got to be easy to hire a couple nerds that know Wikipedia to keep your shit straight. And yet Star Trek can't ever do this properly.
Yeah. Star Trek's trying to be.
Generational struggles with keeping their lore. You know, and it's one thing to change something deliberately because, like, hey, this is a new direction. It's another that, like, clearly you just don't know what the fuck you're doing. So I feel like time and time again, Favreau has showed that we're in pretty good hands with him. Mm-hmm. The people running this show are Star Wars fans.
Yeah. I mean, they're bigger Star Wars fans than I am, certainly. They've got references from everything Star Wars. You were talking about, you know, that old Knights of the Old Republic game. They're talking about, like, Star Wars Rebels and Clone Wars, and you know, the prequels are in here. There's just a million different things referenced in this episode.
When I was like halfway through, and I was like, I wonder if it'd be interesting to come up with a metric like Wikipedia entries per minute, like WEPMs, and like you've got like a hard drive. There's inputs, outputs on that. You've got different statistics like read versus write performance, because there's two ways. Like, how many references to Wikipedia are they making per minute, and how many Wikipedia articles are they causing to be written per minute?
Oh God,
because you know, like, every single time, like, oh, look at these armadillo desert rats. That's probably something they just came up with, and they're going to have a Wikipedia entry now. Mos Pelago or whatever. It's like, that's now, like, that probably wasn't in Wikipedia. Maybe it is. Maybe there's a collection of all the different Moses on Tatooine. Mm-hmm. But it just feels very dense in the same way that, like, Lord of the Rings does, where it's like, if you notice it, it's there. If you don't, it's just part of a real lived-in universe.
And that's key, right? It can't be so bogged down in these references and so, like, in your face with them that people who aren't clued into them don't enjoy the episode. And I think this show never falls into that trap.
Nope.
I don't know. Maybe we should start talking about the episode proper.
We should probably.
Because we'll get to these references as we go along here and kind of point them out a little bit.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood. so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur: Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So the first scene is Manda visiting an underground fighting den to see Gore Koresh for information on another Mandalorian who he thinks will be able to help him sort of track down Baby Yoda's origination. And Gore wants, there's a problem, Gore wants his armor in exchange for the information, which, you know, Mando's not going to give up his armor. And Gore tries to take it at gunpoint. That doesn't work. Mando fights off all of his goons, and then he forces Gore to tell him that the Mando is on Tatooine.
I thought this was a pretty fun action sequence. And, you know, here the Easter eggs are coming fast and furious. We see this fighting pit. These Gamorrean guards fighting each other. This is kind of a reference. A lot of people, I think we even talked about this in a preview episode. A little reference to this very old, obscure PlayStation 1, Generation 1 game called Masters of Terrace.
Cassie, yeah.
Just a way to shoehorn a fighting game into a Star Wars skin. And it featured a Gamorrean guard character by the name of Thok. Fought and I thought this might be the first canonical appearance of vibroblades. You hear about these all the time in the comic.
Well, no, I mean they've used them in season one of Mandalorian.
Oh, really? And they had that same effect, that like shimmery effect.
Yeah, Mando has one. He cuts open the beast, the hairy beast or whatever. I think he kills it with that.
Gotcha.
Can't remember.
But I think that's really cool to see the like vibroblade stuff. Then the Mandalorian muddling. Closing down shop on this guy's entire gang single-handedly with his wrist rockets and his hand to hand. You can't fight a guy hand to hand when he's wearing a helmet. I'm sorry.
You can't. And they run afoul of the armor and the gunfighter stuff occasionally, even in this episode. Yeah. And I'll point it out when we get to it, but he makes a mistake. He tries to challenge Mando. No one challenges Mando and lives. Well, I guess he lives unless these spider bots or whatever the hell they are tear him apart.
Yeah. I got a question though. Do you have an idea? Is the Mandalorian an exceptionally good Mandalorian? Like not good, like virtuous, but like he's like the pinnacle of Mandalorians in terms of skill and weapons and armor. Because this guy, this Gore Koresh, peels Mandalorians out of their armor for a living. Like that's he runs the illicit Beskar metal ring. Yeah. He's got like. Presumably he does this professionally and the Mandalorian just shuts his whole house down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like
that's certainly the story they're telling, right?
I thought the Mandalorian was like a Mandalorian on the come up. You know, he just got his full armor. He just got blessed with his jetpack. He's still got a lot to learn, but apparently he's also just the most Mandalorian of the Mandalorians.
Yeah. He's a gifted beginner. I would say.
Yeah, like a Luke Skywalker, maybe.
Sure.
Like, just off the farm, but hey, you can blow up Death Star. That's not a bad way to look at it, honestly.
Uh-huh.
I liked
seeing all the graffiti as they're walking through this area here. It's like, it's the bad part of town, right?
It's a wretched hive.
Uh-huh, for sure.
So wretched. Full of scum and villainy. And then like just also like if you thought the Mandalorian had gone soft after his season of parenting and his newfound love of droids, he strings up this guy and lets the local wildlife just eat him alive. That was pretty metal for the Mandalorian, I thought.
And they don't show any of it, really. It's all drenched in darkness, right? He shoots out the light, so you can't even see. Even if they showed you, you wouldn't be able to see what was happening to this guy.
Right, but the red eyes creeping closer and closer, and him screaming. Like, I imagine there's a lot of 8-year-olds that were trying to snuggle in the mom and dad's, the side of mom and dad on the couch watching this episode, for sure.
And it's a badass shot, too, right? He shoots the light out, he's walking away, it's kind of where it's shooting over his shoulder as he's walking toward the camera. You know, it's a pretty standard, like, hero shot.
Oh, yeah, those red eyes, that's what I'm saying. Like, if I'm a kid, I'm seeing those for a couple nights afterwards, especially coming right into Halloween. It's creepy time anyway.
Especially killing John Leguizamo. Like, that's the biggest shame of it. This guy, I don't know if you're aware, but he was voiced by Leguizamo himself.
Ah, Leguizamo Leguizamo, huh? That little chestnut.
It didn't really sound like him.
No, he was doing a performance.
He was.
Turns out.
All right, then.
Pretty cool. You're gonna have to get a Mandalorian nightlight for your kids, though, so they don't, and make sure it's just two red LEDs.
Two dots. Yep. So Mando takes off from this planet and heads over to Tatooine. He sets the Razor Crest down in Pelly's port again. You might remember her from season one. She tells him where Mos Pelgo used to be, and maybe still is. And he takes off on a speeder bike so as not to be seen approaching by the bandits who took it after the Empire fell.
Yeah, I like this, the Star Wars kind of like thinking about, you know, post-Empire, that like, it's a you overthrow this despotic tyrannical regime, but there's a power vacuum. And what does that look like for the common men and women around the galaxy? And it had, you know, especially in these places where it's like even the Empire's hold was tenuous, it's going to take the Republic a while to get out here and establish law and justice, and things have kind of gone to shit. I like that, the other kind of, like, you know, in some of my favorite articles in the like Apocrypha, is like the people that do studies on, like, you know, that the Death Star actually blew up over the Forest Moon. The sheer tonnage of that entering the atmosphere and raining down would just cause this Ewok Holocaust. It's like right after everybody danced and did the yub yub, you're gone.
Yeah,
all those teddy bears scorched.
They all had
toxic metal rain.
They had to go underground. 16 generations from now, they're going to come back up. You're not even going to recognize the Ewoks, right? They're going to have no eyes. Yeah.
It's going to be albino. They're going to have giant jaws that can swallow you whole. It's crazy. But I do like this kind of more realistic, because we always see the heroes and they always fuck shit up and they tear stuff down and everybody's cool. In Coruscant, they're throwing stormtroopers into the fountains and whatnot. But here in Tatooine, people are getting enslaved. Shit's real.
Yeah. And I like how they do the flashback with Cobb, his character, because it gives you kind of, you know, a whole story there, right? It gives you the fall of the Empire and the Death Star, and it takes you all the way through to what is a few years later, I guess. Even sure how long after the fall of the Empire is this supposed to take place.
So the Mandalorian takes place 9 ABY, which is after the Battle of Yavin, that's the climax of the original Star Wars, A New Hope.
The first Death Star, right?
Yep. So that means we're about 5 years after Return of the Jedi, as the Mandalorian opens.
The music here was a little strange for me. It felt like coming out of that scene with the red eyes and the Mandalorian theme and the title card, that this song they played as he flies to Mos Eisley there is like too triumphant. We're 5 minutes into this episode. We're 5 minutes into what I think is going to be a season-long, at least, journey to find Yoda's homeworld, or where he came from, Yoda.
His people.
It just felt like we had landed at the final destination and we were ready to, like, see the end of this journey with the music they were playing. It felt a little too triumphant, a little out of place to me.
I'm not going to disagree with you. I think what they're going for is to evoke the beginning of the pod race type of music, like this pomp and circumstance. But It's weird because I don't associate Tatooine with its like largest Boonta Eve race where you've got like a pageantry and all that kind of stuff. I associate it with like the wretched hives of scum and villainy,
especially this era of Tatooine, right? Because that was 30 years ago.
That was back during the Great Republic, where before things had, you know, Mos Eisley, you know, Tatooine's a place like modern day Afghanistan. You know, you look at in the 70s or Iran, you see how like cosmopolitan everything looked, and then it gets a war every 6 years or so, and then like it, yeah. So you're right. You're right. It was a little bit of a maybe a tonal mismatch.
And the show is usually so good. Like all the other music in this show is excellent. It clashed for me.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get a quick montage of Mando journeying to Mos Pelgo. He goes to the cantina where he finds Cobb Vanth, the marshal of Mos Pelgo. He's wearing Boba Fett's armor. Mando demands that he take it off, and he refuses. And Mando's about to kill him and take the armor, but the crate dragon passes through the town, distracting them.
I do think that they could have... Well, I guess this town is maybe on the rebound after the marshal came and he's been holding law and justice, because I did feel it looked a little less sacked than I was expecting.
Yeah.
You know, it looked like something they made out of brand new concrete forms out in the desert, because that's no doubt what they were.
Yeah, especially for what amounts to that Western frontier town, you know, where people are just getting by, trying to stake their claim on a gold mine.
There could be some blaster scorch marks on the walls. Maybe some of those could be like a corner's torn, especially since it's crate. This crate dragon's been rampaging for a couple seasons now. Mm-hmm. Like, make everything. Maybe a couple of the buildings are sinking at a different angle because it swam underneath them. It is a little too perfect. It reminded me a lot of like seeing right before the Star Wars experience at Disney launched, and like I saw some pictures of like the park itself with no people in it. It's like, oh, this is obviously brand new and shiny and. Nobody, no kid, no person has spit on the sidewalk. Like, it reminded me of that.
Not enough spilled hot dogs and sodas.
Yeah. You know, that's like, it felt a little bit, honestly, like prequel era stuff, where it's like, in the classic trilogy, everything, like you look at Luke's X-Wing and it's like got like coolant dripping down and grease and scorch marks and stuff. Whereas in the prequels, everything was shiny and parade ready and ornamental. And I felt like, some of that's minor complaints, but distress this shit. Yeah. If you're going to sell a distressed border town, then have it be a little dingier than maybe it is.
And they're always, you know, spot on with that stuff in the rest of the show. It was a little surprising. I think of the Razor Crest, right? It practically is falling apart at some point.
Yeah. That's exactly the kind of Star Wars engineering I think about when you're talking about bounty hunters and people living on the fringes of society that don't have unlimited funds.
Yeah. I will say it did look weather-worn, like the sand had blasted some of the paint off and things like that. It maybe just didn't have the battle damage I expected.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, speaking of maybe not having the exact right look, What'd you think of Timothy Oliphant when he shows up in that doorway wearing Boba Fett's armor?
I loved it. It looked like a guy who's wearing armor that doesn't fit him, and he has the stereotypical Timothy Oliphant lean.
He absolutely does, like,
one shoulder's higher than the other, one leg's cocked out. He kind of walks like Captain Jack Sparrow three months in recovery.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's still kind of lurching from place to place, but he's no longer three bottles of rum into the day. It's Seth Bullock from Deadwood wearing Boba Fett's chest and head and armor and gauntlets. And it looks exactly like that.
Such a mismatch, right? It's like, this guy does not belong in this armor. You can look over across the room and see Pedro Pascal filling out this armor. And then you see the lanky Timothy Oliphant over there, you know, loosely rattling around in Boba Fett's old armor. It's really funny. Like, when he stepped up in that doorway, I'm like, I'm not supposed to be, like, impressed, am I? Because I'm not.
Right, and I was thinking, like, I was thinking all kinds of things. Like, well, this could be, you know, the rumored appearance of Boba Fett. This could be the other thing. And then he opens his mouth. I'm like, well, that's Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah.
But I still didn't know if he was like a Mandalorian or what.
There were so many leaks that I already knew, like Timothy Olyphant was going to be wearing Boba Fett's armor, but he, you know, he wasn't Boba Fett.
Right, but they don't keep you guessing for very long. Like, he sits down and takes off. I love the way they portrayed, like, even though you can't see Pedro Pascal's face, he's probably not even in the armor. Like, just like you could see his eyebrows shoot up to the top of his helmet when Cobb took his helmet off, because that's something, you know.
Well, this brings me to the whole the whole confrontation between them. This is where they run afoul a little bit of the idea that, like, there's any threat of a blaster, of a sidearm, to Mando, right? Like, they stand there in their dual pose, like they're cowboys in the middle of the street at high noon, and they're going to shoot each other down. But I'm not scared for either of them because they're both wearing Mandalorian battle armor. It doesn't pose any threat.
Yeah.
And then later in the episode, like, they prove that, right? By having Mando get shot, or actually, no, having Cobb get shot in Boba Fett's armor and it just bouncing right off of him.
And they said the same thing in the first episode of The Mandalorian. He takes a shot in his Beskar. Like, this is just bulletproof. It's like John Wick wearing a suit, where I think that going forward, the suspense is precision. Like, if you can aim, like, you know, we've seen the Mandalorian get shot in the gut or get shot in the thigh or get shot in the shoulder. Like, you have to, like a big knight wearing full plate armor, you got to get your sword jammed into the armpit or to the groin or to the neck. Like, you got to find the weaknesses, because, yeah, if you just try to shoot him in the head or the heart, it's just going to pating, or whatever the blaster equivalent of that would be.
Anywhere that could do actual real damage is covered. Yeah.
I thought it was weird that the bartender, they call him Weequay. That's the name of the species. That's like if you had the Chewbacca behind the bar and they said Wookiee.
I mean, maybe
it is. It's I just thought it was weird that they didn't, that the because it felt like the Cobb and him were friends. Felt like all this community, like everyone really respected Cobb. He was the. He's like the, you know, the law and order in a town by everyone's consent and decree. So,
and it makes sense once we see his backstory, right? That he came here and essentially liberated all these people who were slaves. Yeah.
Yeah. Very selfless. He could have taken his armor and gone off and been a bounty hunter, but he loved the town and he came back to save it.
So then Cobb asks Mando to help him kill the Krayt Dragon in exchange for the armor, and he agrees. They can't use the Razor Crest, though, so they journey to the Krayt Dragon's den on speeder bikes. And on the way, Cobb explains the history of Mos Pelgo and how he got his armor and subsequently retook the settlement.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. There's some good Baby Yoda moments here, too, with him, his ears flopping in the breeze. I thought that was pretty good. And also, just real briefly, we know this is Boba Fett's armor, just for people who might not be the biggest Star Wars fans. Primarily because it's not the markings, because, you know, anyone could grab Mandalorian armor and paint it wherever you want. It's that there's a distinctive dent in his helmet in a very particular position that is an exact match for Boba Fett's armor. Also, the fact that Jawas would have it on Tatooine makes sense, because the last we heard of Boba Fett, he's being digested into the pit of the stomach of a Sarlacc. Like the details of, like, the armor looking like it's etched a little bit, like acid etched, or its paint has been worn off.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, it depends on how much you know about Sarlaccs, but yeah, they digest you slowly over thousands of years, obviously, as they say in the original trilogy. Now, Cobb Vanth is not a new character, and he shows up in a series of books. What did you call them?
Called Aftermath. It's like it's a trilogy, a canon trilogy, as opposed to the Star Wars legend stuff that came out, I think, in 2018. And it deals with this connective time period between the old trilogy and the new trilogy, like the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Empire. What did the galaxy look like?
And I guess specifically as it relates to the Boba Fett armor, there's some information in there about how the Jawas maybe have collected the armor in the aftermath of Jabba's barge going down in the desert.
I read the main article for the series, but I didn't look into, like, the details of it. Are they implying that, like, the Sarlacc shit this armor out, or are they implying that
does the Sarlacc shit? Like, I don't know if a Sarlacc shits.
does a Sarlacc shit in the desert, Jim?
It wouldn't shit anywhere else, I can tell you that.
I don't know, because, like, you know, this is a Star Wars legend, because this is Tales of the Bounty Hunter, but, like, right. I always thought, my backstory is my man Dengar came back from Boba Fett, fished him out of there, nursed him back to health, and, changed both of the men's life forever. I wonder, because just because stuff is Star Wars legend doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that Lucasfilm and Disney have reserved the right to say it's not true, but we've seen time and time again how they are directly mining this material for information for the canon, because like Grand Admiral Thrawn survived the canonization. I wonder if they'll keep to that backstory or what, because so far it's really, really mysterious.
There's some other interesting callbacks in here. We see Cobb grab, he says he grabbed every what he could, and he took off when the mining corporation mining collective showed up to take over Mos Pelgo, and what he grabs is something called a Camtono, which I think has just been named here in this show. I'm not sure it had a name before.
It's a space bucket, right?
It's a space bucket, but this is hilarious, because in Empire Strikes Back, one of the things you see is some guy running down a hallway with what everybody called the ice cream maker, like when Darth Vader took over and Mos Eisley was going down, or not Mos Eisley, when Cloud City was going down. Everybody was like, this is the thing he grabs, a fucking ice cream maker. Well, it turns out, this was a container that held things, and now it has a name, a Camtona.
I like it. I like it. I like the there's a lot of stuff, little Easter eggs in this the Jawa scenes. Mm-hmm. I really like the speeder bike scenes, because did you notice that Timothy Oliphant is essentially riding half of Anakin's pod racer?
It's very, very similar. Yeah,
it doesn't have the same markings, but the exact same make and model and coloration. So it doesn't have to literally be his, just like that red R5 right. droid doesn't have to, that Amy Sedaris's character had, doesn't literally have to be. I know that they had its dome had some damage repaired, so maybe it had a bad motivator, but the way I look at that is, like, there's a million R5 astromech droids in this galaxy, and if they are known for having bad motivators, there's a couple hundred thousand that have had repaired motivators.
Yeah,
so it's like, I don't know that it's important for this to be the right R4, D5, or whatever, but it is cool that someone would take a pod racer that we know is, like, barely controlled speed thing and just essentially strap bars and pegs to it and ride like a motorcycle.
Yeah.
It's so fucking cool.
That is cool. So then they stop for some reason.
Oh, wait, one other big Star Wars wank in this flashback scene of him taking care of these mercenaries. Boba Fett's backpack rocket.
Oh, yeah. He uses that in the flashback and in the later episode.
And when we were kids, I always thought that weird thing in the top of Boba Fett's helmet was an antenna. But in visual dictionaries in the years since, they said that no, that's actually intended to fold down like a rangefinder. Like a virtual weapons aid, and I love that he actually used it as such. And also kind of, it looks goofy when he fires the rocket. He kind of, like, does this Japanese bow.
Hunches over, sure.
Yeah, like the rocket can't, you have to kind of aim it. You know, it can't just do a parabolic arc to its target. That would be too cool. But I love the him using the rangefinder was super cool.
Yeah. So they stop in the desert for some reason. I'm actually not sure if they're setting up camp or what. And Mando uses his Tusken language skills to team up with some Tusken Raiders who also want the Great Dragon dead. In their camp, Cobb gets into an argument with one, and Mando is forced to intervene, finally asking how they're going to kill the Great Dragon.
Yeah, it's like, there's a lot. There's strengths using the spaghetti western blueprint. There's weaknesses, like, because this is literally a cowboys and Indians story. But if you map too much onto that, then, like, some of this stuff might come across as offensive. But I thought it was good, kind of like, who did wrong to who. It doesn't matter. You got to face this larger threat.
And I think it's just pretty good cool stuff. Seeing Mando speak Tusken. Like, I don't know. They're kind of filling out his character a little bit, you know? He is a guy who spends, obviously, a lot of time here and out in the desert. And this, I wonder how many other languages he speaks, right? Does he speak Gamorrean? Right. Does he speak Twi'lek or Twi'lek, whatever?
And that's the cool thing is, like, where you can get away with, it's, like, not a one-to-one. Because the Sand People are really... You know, there's Bedouin traditions in there. Mm. There's like it's like they're like they look like Bedouins, live like Native Americans, and raid like Vikings.
Sure.
It's got a lot of that stuff, and the fact that Mando's there vouching for it, it's like, hey, you know, you can think what you want about these people, but they're honorable and they keep their word, and you know, there's implications that, you know, there's a lot of the strife between the settlement and them, there's a misunderstanding. And just seeing them do the language, like, I like how it was like very, it's not just the words themselves, but there's this layer of like gesture based, like almost sign language that component to it that I thought was really cool.
Yeah. So then they journey to the Krayt Dragon's den, which is an abandoned Sarlacc pit, where they try to lure it out with a live bantha, but it eats the handler instead. And then Mando and the Tuskens work out some new ideas for killing the Krayt Dragon, which involves getting a whole lot of Cobb's townspeople to volunteer.
Yeah, that reaction shot of the three Sand People start like look through the like seeing their fellow Sand person getting eaten, I thought was pretty, because it's, I don't know, the design of the Sand People's face is kind of like shocked Pikachu, and. Okay. Yeah. I don't know whether they found this scene and just like when they're filming, but like just having these guys kind of have that reaction was comical. I busted out laughing just the looks on these guys' face after their dude got eaten.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other things like, it makes sense like that this structure, I guess, is a Sarlacc. Like if, you know, like, like, I guess the Sarlacc crawls in and out of this thing, or maybe the Krayt Dragon, like, hollowed it out to get at it, but the fact that this Krayt Dragon's so big it ate a fucking Sarlacc? Mm-hmm. Pretty wild. You know, we've seen the bones of Krayt Dragons before in the original Star Wars. There's these huge, like, dinosaur-looking bones that C-3PO and R2-D2 walk past in the desert. But this is, like, what, an order of magnitude bigger than even that huge skeleton we saw in the desert? That's a big dragon.
I think so. Yeah, it's cool because when they blow up the dragon, finally, they show a shot very similar to the bones that we saw in the desert in the original movie.
Yeah, this is very like Paul Atreides from Doom shit. Like, these are some sandworms, baby.
Mm. Yeah, they treat Tatooine like it's almost like it's a sea, right? It's the inverse of like Waterworld, right? The desert is the ocean to these gigantic creatures, the like a Trimmers kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like what they do with Tatooine here.
Yeah, I was waiting for Reba McEntire to show up with her elephant gun.
Yeah.
It'd been funny if they had like a curly redheaded lady in the mining town, you know, with a little bit of, because Timmy the Elephant has a little bit
he's kind
of
his, Kevin
Kentucky
Bacon.
Justified accent. He is
he's the Kevin
a little
Bacon
Kevin
of this
Bacon.
Trimmers episode.
For sure. For sure. Got to do something about this graboid, man. Uh-huh. It's tearing up my town.
So they go back to Mos Pelgo and explain the situation to the townspeople. They're reluctant to team up with the Tusken Raiders, but Mando is able to convince them with the help of Cobb, obviously. And they begin packing their gear, and the Tuskens show up. Things are a little tense, but they set off together anyway.
Yeah, they're going to use, I presume these are like mining explosives. They've got all these different explosive charges, and there's this cool scene where they just load up this bantha.
Mm-hmm.
With which I thought that's Chekhov's bantha if I've ever seen one. I know I've seen enough of these Belly of the Beast things. I kind of know where this is going. But yeah, it's a good speech where, you know, the Marshal and Mando kind of team up to convince the townspeople to work. It's the same thing they did with the Tuskens, except for now they'd have to do it to townsfolk.
And it's like, you know, if they respect Cobb this much, right? He comes back and he saves them and he does it all using Boba Fett's armor. What are they get? How are they going to respect a real Mandalorian? You know, someone who's...
Their reputation always precedes them. Like, everyone knows, like, what do you know about Mandalorians? They're good at killing.
Yep.
Well, we got one on our side now. And he thinks we need these Tusken Raiders. So,
yeah,
you know, you guys can't even save yourself from some human mercenaries, let alone this thing.
So then the great dragon's sleeping when they arrive at its den, and they have to, it's all like a bunch of exposition, like explaining, oh, how they have to attack it and all this. They got hit in its weak belly, so they plant explosives near the entrance with a plan to lure it out again. And it looks like it's not going to work. It's not going to take the bait, but they toss a bunch of explosives in its face, and they pull it out with harpoons, and then they blow it up. Unfortunately, that doesn't do it. It's not dead. Mando and Cobb go after it with their jetpacks, which is sweet. And they get it to eat a bantha along with Mando. And when it resurfaces, that's the same bantha you're talking about with the explosives on it. When it resurfaces, Mando flies out and detonates those explosives, and it's dead.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's something cool they do at the beginning of this fight when they get they pull it out of the cave, and it's the crate dragon is rushing towards the camera. The aspect ratio, it zooms in and gets rid of the letterboxing, and then you get full screen action for the duration of the battle of the crate dragon, which I thought was really cool. Like, I don't know that canonically it could spit acid fire, but that was really fucking wild. It's just dissolving tons of sand people and townspeople. Getting to the top of that mountain like it's the demon from Night on Bald Mountain, and just raining down acid on people.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, the two Mandalorians flying to the top to try to like distract it and save the people. All that stuff, I thought that is just really good.
Oh yeah, if I'm 10 years old, this is one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
I'm looking forward for Jack to see it tonight when he comes over. But then I'm not exactly sure how this works, because like there's some blue lightning coming out, like implying that, I don't know, the Mandalorian activated his armor theft device, anti-theft device or something, shocked the shit out of his crate dragon, but he's able to get out in time for it to explode. I mean, I think we're seeing how Boba Fett escaped from the Sarlacc, essentially.
Sure.
Right? Like, he probably has the same capabilities and whatnot. But yeah, it's cool. It's cool. I thought it was weird when he said, I need you to take care of the child. Was he actually saying, like, if I don't make it out of this, like, I'm setting you up with a life debt? Or is it just kind of like, literally watch the kid while I'm in the guy's gullet for a minute?
Maybe both. I don't know. Maybe he wasn't sure he was going to make it, and yeah, it could be a life debt kind of thing.
It's also a reference to the Return of the Jedi, because the Mandalorian smacks Cobb on his backpack and sends him into a Boba Fett death spiral.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Mandalorian should look in fixing that.
For sure.
Tap your back. If someone taps your backpack and you go uncontrollably flying for 30 seconds, it's gotten two people wearing the armor in trouble just from what I've seen, you know? Mm-hmm. So maybe put a switch on to cover that switch or something.
I do like when it eats Mando, everybody looks around like they're totally boned, right? Like, oh shit, they just ate our best guy. Oh, yeah. We're done. Right. Call the mission off.
But, star quarterback just broke his knee. We're done.
Of course, you know he's coming back out. And afterward, Cobb gives back Boba Fett's armor. The Tuskens pull a pearl out of the Great Dragon, which is a nice bit of Star Wars fiction there. Mando takes off, and we see a mysterious scarred-up bounty hunter watching in the distance. Who could it be?
It's definitely played by Tamara Morrison.
Yeah.
Who, if you'll recall, is Boba Fett's father in the prequel trilogy, Jango Fett. And he commissioned the Kaminoan clone masters to make a precise clone, unlike the other clones they made of him. It wasn't going to have that subservient mental conditioning, and it wasn't going to be accelerated growth. They're going to give him as a baby for him to raise as his own. Mm-hmm. Now I guess technically could be just one of the other surviving clone troops, but I think with his age, those clone troops would be like Ben Kenobi old. They'd be like in their 70s or 80s at this point,
right?
So with his scarring and the fact that he's tracking Boba Fett's armor, I mean, most people, I think it's pretty clear that this is the big Boba.
Yeah, which is super exciting. I mean, this was spoiled. This was spoiled. I don't know. I read about it weeks ago, so like, it wasn't a huge oh my god kind of moment, which is unfortunate. Yeah. You know, like if they had done with Boba Fett what they did with Baby Yoda, I think everybody would have had their fucking mind blown in this episode.
Yeah, I wonder why they didn't. Because, like, you know, the fact that they could have had some dude just wearing his armor and kind of have that mystery. Now, in its defense, like, okay, well, if it's you're saving a surprise for the first episode, like, what is the real shocking thing?
Right.
You know, they might have given away little tidbits like this just to really, you know, keep the stuff that's going to be, you know, like, what's the Baby Yoda of season two going to be?
So Luke Skywalker. Baby Luke.
Yeah, wouldn't that be wild?
Yeah.
CGI Mark Hamill coming back.
That'd be crazy.
He's aged out. He's aged out of young Luke role for sure. I mean, you've seen the new movies.
For sure.
But yeah, no, I think it's cool. The look, they said that this was based on a particular high end the Star Wars action figure version of like a Ben Kenobi from like immediately after the prequels, where he still had his clone trooper armor on, but he was wearing like Ben's robes over that, and he had this exact backpack. He was wearing it. So they're pulling a lot of, like, I guess, some of the costume design from some of this concept art and some of these high-end toys and things that literally only live in like visual dictionaries and stuff.
Yeah,
but it looks really cool, like a Boba Fett that's gone native. My question is, like, is it really taking him 5 years to crawl out of the Sarlacc pit and track down his armor? And he's like, literally, like, God damn it, I was about to get this armor.
I don't know. I guess so. I guess it'd be nursed back to health. You know.
Yeah.
I wonder what his capabilities are at this point. Is he the same old Boba?
Plus, he doesn't have his armor. How much of the, you know, the secret sauce is wearing Beskar armor?
It was interesting to see that Baby Yoda had almost nothing to do in this episode. And it wasn't even a MacGuffin, like, wasn't driving the plot, wasn't... I mean, at a high level, like, Baby Yoda is driving the entire plot, but...
Right.
Like, nothing in this episode really did much. Because even then, like, you know... Okay, Mando gets this armor, but he didn't actually find a Mandalorian, right? So what's his next lead? Who knows? Probably Boba Fett, if I had to guess. Boba Fett will find him, right?
Boba Fett's, In Tatooine, Boba Fett finds you.
But that's the end of the episode. I love the meat cube, the giant meat cube that they take with them. They just pack it, you know, wrap it up in some cloth, and they got just this huge chunk of Great Dragon on the back of that speeder.
You can eat off a crate dragon cube for months, man.
I bet you can.
Just slice a little bit. It's like ready-made jerky. You know, those things are naturally dehydrated living out in the desert.
It's true. It's true.
No, it's a good episode. Shall we look at what people sent in for feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. So the way to send feedback is Mando at baldmove.com, or there is a thread discussing The Mandalorian on our forums at forums.baldmove.com. First up, Tam Jones says, I'm a longtime listener, so you can imagine I'm so excited you're covering The Mandalorian. My view experience will now be complete. Having said that, I wanted to beg you to do something to enhance the coverage and infuse it with canon. Do yourselves and us a favor and watch Star Wars Rebels.
There's like 48 seasons, man.
During the 100-day lockdown here in Melbourne, I watched the entire Star Wars franchise, including Clone Wars, Rebels, and Resistance from start to finish, and truly found Clone Wars and Rebels to be canon-expandingly ultra-satisfying viewing. That's his reputation. My problem is when I, during the lockdown, I was watching The Walking Dead and making a podcast. My funsy Star Wars time was fucking around with Negan and Rick's people.
Yeah.
There are so many references that are important to Mando season two from these two series, Ahsoka and her journey, her link to Sabine Wren, who's a major character in Rebels and who we think is the mystery character played by Sasha Banks. And oh yes, bring back Ezra Bridger. See, these are all references I don't understand.
Sabine Wren, I looked it up because I got into a graffiti hole in Star Wars, and it's apparently a Mandalorian whose trademark is like graffitiing things. Has graffiti bombs that she throws off.
Also, Rebels viewing can provide you with access to cool and critical details around Mandalorian culture, the source of the Black Saber, most importantly, why Katie Sackhoff's character Bo-Katan, who was given the Dark Saber in Rebels, seems to have lost the saber and might be coming back for it. With so much rich backstory, you got to go for it, boys. You won't be disappointed.
Or I could spend 6 hours reading it all. Like, that's the thing. You can go to do this research. Like, I'm familiar with some of the stuff you're talking about now just because I spent an hour researching it.
Yeah. And it's just like, I can't watch 100 hours of Star Wars between now and even the end of the season. So I will be doing my due diligence that way. And also, if The Mandalorian's worth its salt, they're going to know that small percentage of its overall fan base is going to have seen all of the Star Wars. So they're going to have to introduce all these concepts, you know, for people that are unfamiliar with it, like myself. But I have no doubt. Like, I've seen quite a bit of the Clone Wars. And I saw a little bit of season one of the Rebels. I just haven't seen it all, but I'll definitely be doing the research on it. But I also kind of like the other thing, advantages. I have a less clear idea of where the season's going to. And I think that's kind of fun too, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, we got more on this later. Gary Zegerbear says, super nerdy me is very excited you're covering this season of Mandalorian. I'm a huge fan of the Clone Wars and Rebels, and there's a good deal of backstory for the Mandalorian religion. You don't say. The Darksaber, their stances on the Empire, Jedi, Republic, and the later seasons of both series. I want to talk more about the Darksaber. Apparently, it was once held by a Mandalorian named Tara Vizsla and was given as a gift from the Jedi. He was also the only Mandalorian to ever be granted into the Jedi Order. Wow. Later become the leader of his Vizsla clan. It has since been passed down through many generations as the King of the Mountain type inheritance. Darth Maul even held it once in Clone Wars. Bo-Katan's clan had it too, and even Sabine from Rebels. The Darksaber was last seen in Rebels by Bo-Katan and a few remaining clan. By the way, okay, we already got this. That's going to be Katie Sackhoff's character.
Yeah.
I didn't know she voiced that also in the animated version.
Apparently. Wow. As soon as Moff Gideon shows back up, I'm doing my Darksaber deep dive.
Yeah. In fact, they're just saying that when Moff Gideon has it, means he possibly won it from a Mandalorian clan or even Bo, and is technically their new ruler.
I don't know.
Interesting. On the baby Yoda, who do you think the child is, and why is he being sought after so hard? Is it a clone of Yoda? Is it a regular Circle of Life species birth, a reincarnation?
My wife and I like to think that it's possibly he's a Dalai Lama type figure. When one dies, another is born spiritually and is responsible for passing on the practice of religion. What do you guys think?
I've never heard
that particular theory before, but that's strong. Yeah, like an last force bender.
Oh, I was thinking from like a balance in the force kind of perspective, it makes a lot of sense.
It's his age. 50 years old is hard to, like, that's 10 years before the prequel trilogy, right? 10, 15 years?
Roughly, yeah.
I don't know, like, why would you clone Yoda in that time period? Like immediately after, like when he's dead and they've got like some there's some Yoda blood in the Senate chambers after him and Palpatine threw down. I could see cloning him then, but like it seems like he'd just be a natural child. And I think there is a Yoda species just because we don't know its name and, you know, where they come from. I do think there'll be a planet full of them. So I don't know about the clone. I do like this idea of it being a Dalai Lama type reincarnated character, some kind of sacred figure.
Yeah.
It's also weird because I think something I've always struggled to understand about Star Wars is why the Jedi as are seen as a myth less than just a couple of decades after they were
one
the
generation
secret
later.
Police of the galaxy. Not even a secret police. They were like the FBI of the galaxy. Like if 20 years from now, or if today we hunted the FBI to extinction, you would still know about FBI, right?
You would think so, yeah.
But people always said that's just how ruthless the Empire was at cracking down, that in a single generation, people, if you weren't alive to know about the Jedi, then you just thought they were hokey religions and ancient this and that. So
I don't know. Information is hard to suppress.
It is. But also, we've never been ruled, fortunately, by horrifying space warlocks that can fuck with people's minds and force choke you. So, working on that. Maybe in 2030, we can have a horrifying space warlock rule over us.
2022.
Won't that be nice?
You know, don't give ourselves too much credit.
Horrifying space warlock, 2024.
Yeah.
Let's see. Will says, it seems like you could use a little background info on some of the characters' lore for the upcoming season. As a new canon-obsessed fan, I just thought I'd provide some background. I attached a document with some info on Boba Fett, Ahsoka Tano, and the Darksaber. I thought we'd go through some of this and just gonna provide our commentary. Boba Fett, on the podcast, you discussed Boba Fett being a Mandalorian, but to my knowledge, he's not. Boba Fett inherited the armor from Jango, who came upon the armor through seemingly nefarious ways. Although Fett wore Mandalorian armor, the government of Mandalore saw him as nothing more than a common mercenary and insisted he had actually no ties to the Mandalorians in the Wikipedia. But, you know, I looked in the article you referenced, and literally the next paragraph says that Jango Fett always maintained that he was from a planet that was the homeworld of the Mandalorians. So it's like, is he cast out? Is he, like, excommunicated? Is he embarrassment to the Mandalorians? To me... That screams red lights. There's more to this story.
Gotcha.
I don't know. And also, I have no idea how much they plan on respecting a lot of this Boba Fett lore.
Yeah, so, we'll probably learn a substantial amount more about Boba Fett in the next few episodes.
I agree. Ahsoka Tano says she has interesting ties to the Mandalorians. Of course, this is... Anakin Skywalker's Padawan during the Clone Wars series. She has interesting ties to Mandalorians. She helped Bo-Katan, that's the Sackhoff character, take back control of Mandalore from the rule of Darth Maul. Speaking of dudes that we thought were dead down a big pit and come back.
Yeah.
During the siege of Mandalore during the end of the Clone Wars, this takes place in season 7. You weren't kidding how many seasons this show's got.
If you could just get through those first 6, then you can finally get to the info you need.
Yeah, yeah. Episodes 9 through 12 of the Clone Wars TV show, I'd highly recommend these. They're basically a feature film cut into 4 parts, and it's a self-contained story. So this is some actionable information.
Mm-hmm.
4 episodes that I can watch to enjoy this particular part of Mandalorian, I can do that.
Yeah.
I cannot watch all of Rebels, Clone Wars, and read the comic books from 1987 through 1994 and, you know, read Tales from the Bounty Hunters and all that. I can watch four episodes of a cartoon series, though. Some more background on Ahsoka. She left the Jedi Order during the Clone Wars after being falsely accused of an attack on the Jedi Temple.
That damn Anakin.
He's the one that did it.
Yep.
This is a few episodes story arc in the show. It showed Anakin and Ahsoka how blindly the Jedi were following their dogma, as well as beginning to foreshadow Anakin's disappointment in the Jedi Order and his fall to the dark side. Damn shame they couldn't do that in the films.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Darksaber, he says, has an interesting story that has changed hands numerous times throughout Star Wars canon. I won't go into much details, it would take forever, but the basics are the Darksaber is created by this person called Tara Vizsla, the first Mandalorian to enter the Jedi Order. Oh, wait, have we already talked about this stuff?
Seems like we have, yeah. How it passed.
I'll pull up the new details. The difference of this from typical typical lightsabers is it can parry other blades with some kind of magnetic pull.
Parry other blades? Like what do you mean? Other lightsabers or physical blades? Like it doesn't cut through
them? I think physical
them?
Blades. Yeah, like it repulses or pulls them to it. It's got some kind of special power that way.
Seems worse, right? That seems worse to me.
Well, if it pulls like a vibro blade towards it and cuts it in half, then that's kind of cool. But yeah, like this again, asserting that the person has a Darksaber is the leader of Mandalore, which is interesting in terms of Gideon seemingly wiping out an entire town of them. Anyway, those are the main points that they wanted to provide us with. I appreciate that. And I am going to try to check out this particular story, the season 7 episodes 9 through 12, because it does seem like that's the heart of the stuff that I want to see.
Yeah, I definitely want to bone up on this stuff, cuz I've never seen Clone Wars or Rebels, but it seems like it's going to be valuable talking about the rest of the show. Yeah.
But yeah, I appreciate you guys filling in some of those lore holes for us, and we'll continue to do so all season long. Really excited to have the Mandalorian back. It was a lot of fun, and I felt like a kid on Saturday morning, getting up early, coming downstairs on the couch in my pajamas, pouring myself a big bowl of Lucky Charms in my case, and watching the Mandalorian. It was a lot of fun. Had a big smile on my face the whole episode.
Nice.
If you'd like to send us more follow-up, please do so at mando@baldmove.com. Of course, we will have an episode out almost every Friday. I know there's going to be a couple schedule conflicts where we won't be able to get to it until the following Monday. But for the vast majority of the episodes, we'll have same-day coverage when Disney drops it. So thank you for listening to The Tribe of Two. We're excited to have you along on this voyage to the galaxy far, far away. And we'll be back next week for the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.